This is Carlin on 98.7 ESPN.
We got to do something about Edwin Diaz. Carlin, 98.7 ESPN, 800-919-3776, 800-919-ESPN. What a night it is tonight. We go up until 9 o'clock when the NBA Finals Game 6 between the Suns and the Bucks. The Bucks trying to wrap up their first championship in 50 years. The Suns trying to hold on for dear life and get to Game 7. Get involved in the show early and often. 800-919-3776. We're going to be hitting your calls very shortly. We're going to start on Edwin Diaz. We're going to get to some Yankee talk. We're going to get to some NFL talk tonight. And something we're going to do over the next couple of weeks is start to preview the rest of the divisions in the AFC East and in the NFC East. Each night, we will put on somebody who covers or knows particular teams from those divisions inside and out. And this week, we're doing the AFC East, and we begin tonight with the Miami Dolphins at 8 o'clock. Amber Wilson from South Florida and ESPN Radio is going to join us to give us some Dolphins perspective this season. Looking forward to that. I should advise you that I am on Twitter and that you can reach me, as many of you did last night, at Chris Carlin. By all means, hit us up there and over on the gram at That Guy Carlin. So Edwin Diaz blew his third straight save last night. Did you catch that? I don't know if you saw the news that he did. Mets came back and won anyway, which was impressive in and of itself. And I know how much everybody has been on me over the last couple of days since I have really been talking more and more about the fact that I'm just not that sure that they're actually that good and that maybe I should be giving them more love and respect over what they've done in the first half, considering all of the injuries that they've had. It is, in fact, impressive that they have been able to do what they've done. But frankly, there have been many more opportunities to take more advantage of what has transpired in the rest of the division, which has been teams that, frankly, just haven't been very good. So we get to Edwin Diaz. And, you know, we can talk an awful lot about how good he has been last year and really for the most part this year. And I understand where that comes from because he has been very, very good. There have been times, though, that he just doesn't seem to make it easy. And those times, he seemed to be a lot more than you're comfortable with. And then you have the last few days. And this is something that I floated last night and I think might deserve some traction over the next 11 days before the deadline. So I did a little research today. There was some question as to whether or not Craig Kimbrell was actually going to be under team control for next season because he had a vesting option for any team, that trades for him. He will be. He, in essence, will be. His option is either going to vest if he finishes a ton of games this year. He's only at 31 right now. Or he is going to be under control because the team, it reverts to a club option otherwise. So any team that brings him in can have him next year at the $16 million mark. I love Craig Kimbrell. I do, and I'm not afraid to say it. I'm not afraid to tell you that I am in full bloom love with Craig Kimbrell. He has always been one of my favorite closers, and he is somebody that is going to be chased after in the next 10 days. Teams are going to be clawing at the Cubs to try to get him and offering prospects and such. Allow me to float this idea for just a moment. Here's a guy that's had a .53 ERA this year and has given up only 11 hits in 33 2/3 innings. He has struck out 58. He has always been good in this regard. And he has been somebody that has been to the postseason, understands what it's about, and I would trust in many, many big situations. Edwin Diaz is under control for the next 2 years after this year. So in essence, you'd be getting another year of control for a pitcher that is still very young. Is it so far out of the realm of possibility that a team would want Edwin Diaz in exchange for a guy like Craig Kimbrel if you put a little bit more in the deal? You know, I don't think so. I don't think it's out of the realm of possibility. You have Diaz, who is going to be controllable, make $7 million this year, probably going to make, let's say, 12 next year, and maybe 16 the year after that. So you have an additional year with a younger pitcher who another team would absolutely look at and say, this is somebody that we can get in here, and whatever issues he has, we can fix very quickly. So why wouldn't you do that? If you're the Cubs, it's a reasonable price. It's a reasonable return. I'm not saying solely Diaz. I think that would be a case where you'd do that if Kimbrel was not under control for next year too. If he was just a rental, I'd do Diaz straight up. But I have to tell you, I'd do Diaz and a prospect to get Craig Kimbrel here. And I don't think it's so out of the realm of possibility that teams could be looking at Edwin Diaz and considering him to be an attractive option for them. Why would they be thinking otherwise? This guy has had a lot of success in his career, was bad in 2019. There was no value to him then, but has built himself back up over the last year and a half. I just don't know that Edwin Diaz is the guy here. The Mets, for their part, as you would expect, are all still saying the right things, as Luis Rojas did this afternoon.
No thought of it right now.
That's of taking him out of the closer's role.
Steve, what you know the thoughts are here of him. We believe that he has elite stuff. He's shown it. We know he's going through a stretch right now. But the stuff is there. He's got to locate better. And whether he works on his mechanics where he goes out front and he just loses his release point to an arm side causes his slider to back up a lot and causes his fastball to sail into swing paths or be a ball out of the hand. Like he corrects that, he's going to be back on point to the Diaz that we saw earlier in the season. And not even earlier in the season, but the Saturday before the last day right before the All-Star break. That's the Diaz we want. And that's the one that's working right now on getting that he's working on getting to right now. So no talks as of now about that. If we run into a situation like that tonight and he's available, I mean, he should be back in there. You know, we trust this guy. That was the conversation that we had this morning just to make sure that he hears that, you know, there's trust on his abilities of doing this because he's done it in the past. And just to see this as an opportunity of getting better. That's the approach that we're thinking. That's the approach that we're thinking about of anything as a team and also with individuals this season. So, you know, that's where we are right now.
You know, he has really done a nice job, just as a quick aside, of becoming very media savvy. I give Luis Rojas a lot of credit because in there you can sense some real belief in Diaz as a closer. And I'm not saying they should lose complete faith in this guy whatsoever. He has done a great job over the last season and a half or two seasons, whatever you want to call it, to really bring himself back after what seemed to be the depths of despair in this town. At one point, even suggesting, maybe I'm just not a New York guy. Well, for me, this is an opportunity. Opportunity doesn't come along like this every day. And I honestly think if the Mets started not shopping, but poking around what the other possibilities are when you're making trades, and actually considered putting Diaz in a deal, it would be a big benefit to them. It would help them where maybe you're not having to give up a big-time prospect for something that's already a known commodity. Maybe you're giving up Diaz as a known commodity with a decent prospect, B-level prospect, to go and get somebody like Kimbrel and improve the situation. Because believe it or not, as much as it's frustrating to watch, there are people that value what he does. 800-919-3776. Calls are coming up. The lines are open. Would you trade Diaz in a deal for Craig Kimbrel? Knowing that Diaz is only 27. Knowing that he has actually pitched better over the last couple of years, even though fans feel a certain way about him. I genuinely want to know where you are on this, because I don't think it's out of the realm that they could look at moving Diaz in the next 11 days in the right deal. Not just to get rid of him, but to get better. Because I do believe he has value. Right now, we begin on the phones with Anthony in Queens up first tonight. Anthony, what's going on, bud? How are you?
Okay. How are you, Chris?
I'm outstanding, bud.
Well, what you said about Diaz, definitely put him in the trade list, because even though he has pitched so much better this year, I never feel comfortable with him. And it had to do with 2019. It was just so bad. So bad that I can't remember any other reliever pitching that bad.
Well, there have been many relievers that have pitched that bad, but you have what is known as battle scars, so to speak, or really open wounds that you feel like Edwin Diaz pours some salt in still and rips the scab off every once in a while. Is that fair? Am I accurately portraying that, as disgusting as that sounds?
It's probably more consistent than that.
Yeah, there's a little PTSD worked in there. I understand. I understand where it's coming from, but I don't think it's quite to the level that you're where you'd be being fair here, Anthony. Thanks for the call. Being fair, you would look at this and you would be able to get past what happened in 2019, realizing that's 2 years ago, realizing that he's been much better since. And yes, it's one of those times where you have to be able to put the past behind you. There are guys, there have always been guys that you have not been able to put the past behind you, no matter how good they are. I will not do this to Edwin Diaz. And I want to be clear that this is not a name that I am associating with Edwin Diaz, okay? But as an example of someone who was never able to put that past behind him, or would always, always stick it to you in a big spot, well, of course, I'm talking about Armando Benitez. He is not Armando Benitez. That would be thoroughly unfair to me of me to suggest that. Because to me, Diaz has at least done a much better job of getting himself to a point where teams still see the true value in him and would probably look at this as just a bad stretch. They would not look at him as broken. There was a time in 2019, and justifiably so, where teams would look at him and say, that dude's broken. We can't go near him. How about Jacob? He is in Deal, New Jersey. Jacob, what's going on, bud? How are you?
You don't trade an arm like Edwin Diaz when you're trying to make a run for the postseason. What you do, if you want to get a guy like Kimbrel, you package some prospects, you grab Kimbrel and Bryant from the Cubbies, and you move Edwin Diaz to lower leverage situations. Now you have a bullpen that's the most dominant in the league. So I understand where you're coming from with your suggestion, but it's
But
so,
do you understand what the level of prospect is that you're giving away in a deal like that? Because the Cubs are going to command big time prospects for Kimbrel. What?
You're going to go for it. You're going to go for it, or you're not. But trading Diaz for another bullpen arm doesn't get you anywhere.
No, I'm trading Diaz for a better bullpen arm and a guy that I would trust in the clutch more.
If you're gonna make a push for another bullpen arm, you keep Diaz and you trade. You make a big splash. You put your chips on the table and you give up those prospects that you cherish so much. What did Michael Fulmer do? You cherished him. What did all our prospects ever do? How about Jared Kelenic?
All right,
he hit one home run and then
settle down, Cowboy. All right, just relax. Thanks for the call. Don't point to Jared Kelenic as a failure because he came up once and went through a bad stretch. Let's not do that yet, okay? That's silly on your part. What you want to do, though, is acknowledge that when you have a farm system that's not terribly deep to begin with, there are going to be other teams that have better offers when it comes to great prospects to give. You know, there are, if you honestly want to look at this, and I was reading Jeff Passan's article earlier today on ESPN.com, there are legitimately 17 teams that could be looking for help in the next 11 days. What does that mean? It's a seller's market. Just like houses in the suburbs over the last year and a half, it's a seller's market. So you have to look at that and understand that you're not just going to be able to grab somebody like Kimbrel for, as you put it, just prospects. Like, he could end up costing you your top two in your organization. And how do those top two stack up against the top two somewhere else? The Mets, as far prior to the draft, the Mets basically had a organizational rating around 17 or 18 out of 30 in baseball. That's not the best sign when you have so many teams out there trying to do damage and get help. Gary at the Jersey Shore is next, 98.7 ESPN. Gary, what's up?
Hey, I'm a Yankee fan, big time. First of all, let me give you a little hint. Some of these people come on the radio and they say they're big Yankee fans. Here's the rule that you catch them with. Ask them 50 years ago on a Sunday in August, how did you recognize the program coming out? They had a very specific, MO, but it was for Saturdays and Sundays.
All right, that's 50 years ago. That somebody who's a Yankee fan doesn't have to justify themselves with that. But anyway, go ahead.
Yeah. Anyway, I just thought, they used to come in with a shot in the right field seats. Nobody in the stadium, right field seats, and it would come down. It would, go into where the box was for the broadcast of the game. It was always Red Barber there. Red Barber would he was the guy who any kid he would take care of. He had to have a red pen. He had to sign in red, but that was my recollection. Because they went to a blackboard, and the blackboard had Maris, Mantle, how many home runs each of them had.
Mm-hmm.
It was kind of a thing stuck with me. I don't know why. But listen, I'm kind of thinking, the Yankees, they got this thing where over the years they pitch like a pitcher for a half an inning, and then go to someone else. I mean, they don't really use these young kids. And consequently, it doesn't seem that the manager's all that warm with them. It seems like they come off the bench, they pop down, and nobody said good job, nobody said go to the fastball. It's just it's sort of a learn on your own, and I think there's just a lack of confidence with these kids.
Yeah, I Gary, thanks for the call. Well, first one in a while. 50 years at Barber. Sit down. The manager doesn't like the younger players. Doesn't encourage them. Pat them on the back. I love my job, and it's not a job. But there are moments where it feels a little job-like. And for that last, by my count, 2 minutes and 19 seconds, felt like a job.
I've been a Yankee fan since 1938.
Exactly. You don't need to qualify yourself every time you come on, and you don't need to point to something 50 years ago when we're talking about what's going on right now. I get it. I have lovely memories of when I was a child loving baseball. I don't have to share them with you all the time. For the love of God, man. Please give me my 2 minutes and 18 seconds or whatever that was back. Because you owe it to me and you owe it to everybody in the tri-state area who is just listening. As I talked about yesterday, I have started meditating. I'm going to bring you inside here a little bit. And what you do in this is you sit, you focus on your breathing, you do it for 10 minutes. And yeah, we all have negative thoughts in our minds, right? That inner voice sometimes can be a real jerk. It can be. Well, you're kind of training to just learn to let them pass like clouds in the sky, acknowledging its existence, and then moving on. And it's actually starting to work. But it's moments like that that are going to have my head as red as Bruce Arians was today down at the White House. As somebody tweeted out, Jeff Bezos went to space today. Bruce Arians went to the sun. I can't. Listen to you qualify yourselves every time. I love you. I love you to death. I was one of you. I was a sports radio caller as a kid. I was. And as a young man, before being fortunate enough to get this opportunity. But I'm not just doing this for me. I'm not. Doing this for us. Collectively. You and me, we're in this together. And we both know that wasn't good. That wasn't good. I need some help.
I've been a Yankee fan since never.
Yeah. I just need some help. All right. I'm going to meditate for the next 3.5 minutes. Roughly. We shall reset. The lines are open for you. If you call, I will assume you are qualified. So there's no need to show how long you've been in there. No need. Calm blue ocean. I have to tell you, I doubled back when I saw the Yankees lineup tonight and said, wait, what? Who are these guys? Because earlier, in case you missed it, DJ LeMahieu, right around 6:20 or so, got scratched from the Yankee lineup because of a stomach bug. He did have a COVID test that came back negative, but he's out of the lineup tonight with just that, a stomach bug. But how about the Yankee lineup this evening? There are only 3 right-handed hitters in the Yankee lineup tonight. What? Gardner leading off, Stanton DHing, Odor hitting third, Sanchez cleanup, Torres fifth, Rob Brantley at first base batting sixth, Greg Allen in right field fresh off his WCBS weather forecast. He's in right. Floreal, who got called up earlier today in case you missed it, he's in center field, Wade at third. All right, murderer's row, it is not past Torres. But, I mean, left-handed hitters all over the place. I'm stunned. I didn't know they had this many left-handed hitters in the organization. Wow, 800-919-3776. Let us continue on the phones. Nick in Staten Island is up next on 98.7 ESPN. Hey, Nicky, what's going on?
Hey, how's it going? Thanks for having me.
Yes, sir.
I just wanted to get your thoughts on Aroldis Chapman. And, you know, I don't know if the Yankees will be buyers or sellers at the deadline. It you know, remains to be seen. But what do you think the Yankees should do with him going forward? I mean, he's pretty much imploded this past season. He's not really, you know, a threat. He's not really scary on the mound as he used to be. I mean, I would like to see the Yankees go for Kimbrel. You know, again, I don't know if they're going to be buying or selling, but I feel like they need some bullpen help. What do you think?
Listen, I don't hate the idea. I think when you have Britton back and ready to go, that's going to help immensely. And remember that Britton has he was one of the best closers, if not the best closer in the American League not too long ago. I understand what you're saying about Kimbrel. It's really an interesting scenario with Chapman. And for me, Chapman is the ultimate bully on the mound. He is a guy that he can make you look silly and be as intimidating as possible and blow the ball right past you and then stare you down. And frankly, there are times where you might be scared to death to step into the box. And then there are other times that you're not scared at all. And when you do actually hit him, he goes down like a sack of potatoes because he is that truest bully in that sense. You know, what do they always say about bullies? That you land one punch and they can't respond to it. That's what it feels like with Chapman right now. We had Jeff Nelson on last night talking about the fact that maybe the spin rate and the sticky stuff has a lot to do with it because he just can't seem to control the ball, and he has bailed on the split finger fastball altogether. Good talk. See you out there. Chuck in Old Bridge. Chuck, what's going on? How are you tonight?
Chris, doing great. I've been a Met fan since 1969.
Oh, God.
I really think we got to talk about the old days, about the old bullpens and the innings they pitch. I haven't heard much of your show today, but we really got to talk about the old days when you're talking about these bullpens, Chris.
They don't go long enough. Do you know that Goose Gossage used to get 3-inning saves?
I've been a Yankee fan since 1969.
Wow. Wow. Do you have an actual point to make, or did you just call in for the chuckle?
I love you, Joe. I love when you blow a gasket. It's great radio. It's fantastic. I miss listening to you every day. I wish you get a regular show. It's fantastic, bro. Keep up the good work.
I appreciate that. I mean, I do have a regular show. It's this one. So, you know, and I have been on quite a bit during the midday with Bart filling in, you know, basically, I don't know, every day. So
you're listening to Chris Carlin on 98.7 ESPN.
I mean, I am on twice a day right now. So that's something. If you're not getting enough of a dose of me right now, you've got a problem. You've got a big time problem. Frank in Brooklyn up next, 98.7 ESPN. Frank, what's going on? How are you tonight?
Hey, I'm doing fine. How are you?
I'm good. What do you got for me?
Yeah, I have an interesting question. I'm just looking for some advice. I want to take my kid to the Mets game this Monday because it's at 5 o'clock instead of 1 or 7, which never works. And I just wanted to know, how young is too young to take someone to the baseball game?
Well, how old is your kid?
He is 20 months, almost 2.
Almost 2. I mean, listen, you're not sitting straight through the doubleheader. Let's put it that way. You know,
no, that's not happening.
No, it's not. I don't have kids, so I don't know what it is to tell you how young. I can only go on what I can tell you. And I probably went much later than most kids do. I didn't go to my first game until I was 8, something like that. But I lived, an hour and a half out in New Jersey, and we weren't going to Yankee Stadium or to Shea because that's a whole day in terms of, you know, the investment there. That wasn't happening until I was really able to appreciate it and kind of sit through it. My father was not going to, you know, go out there and have me after three innings say, yeah, let's bag this, Pops. But I would say that at 20 months, if you want to take your kid, take your kid. But just understand they're not going to understand a darn thing of what's going on.
Yeah, that's true. I know Citi Field has like a kid section, a kid zone. And, you know, just having fun running around for a couple of innings.
Yeah.
And it's a doubleheader, it's seven innings anyway.
Yeah. There you go. There you go, Frank. Why not? Who am I to tell you what to do and when to take your kid to the game? I would think, if I had to guess, that the ideal time to start taking kids to games where they're going to remember it down the line, probably around 4 years old, 5 years old maybe. I think I have a few memories of when I was four, but that's about as far back as I go. I had my first beer at five, or at least sip, that I remember. I apparently used to run around, because you got to understand, I'm youngest of six, right? My parents had five kids in 6.5 years, right? Irish quintuplets, if you will, because our family is 100% Irish, and at the time, that is what you did. And then they had me 8 years later as the baby and the guy that wasn't exactly in the plans. So, summertime, everybody would be sitting outside on a patio, and whoever put their beer down, apparently I would run up and grab it and just start chugging. Now, I have no memory of this. I do have a memory of the first time that I had a beer that was, you know, voluntarily is the word. No, that's not the word. Just when I sat down and my brother had gone to the fridge and had gotten himself a Michelob, and he brought one for me. The twist bottles with the little paper. And he handed me a beer, and I was 5 years old, sitting on the front step on the 4th of July. And I said, is this okay? And he looked at me and he said, you got to start sometime. I didn't have another one until I was well into high school, don't get me wrong. And I think I probably took two sips because I hated the taste of it. I'm so done with the Green Bay Packers. Get to that in just a minute. 800-919-3776. The Mets cannot catch a break. They have gotten a combined five innings. This from Tim Healy, which, I mean, you can do the math, but I appreciate him doing it for us. Five innings from their starting pitchers the last three games. Just a few minutes ago, apparently Robert Stock went down on his way to first base and he is out of the game in the second inning, as I'm just watching a replay of it, and he was trying to bust it down the line, and yeah, you got that look. You know what that look is. You get three quarters of the way down the line, you're like, it's something that pulled. Boy, the Mets, listen, I know what I said last night. I will admit they cannot catch a break. That is a kick in the pants. 800-919-3776. The Mets have used 15 different starting pitchers this season. They have had they had 10 different starters that they used in 60 games last year. And this after in 2019, this is from SNY. 154 of the 162 starts, 95% of their starts, were made by six pitchers. So the last 2 years, after getting great consistency and health from their starting pitching, they have had anything but with their health. I want to spend a few minutes on Aaron Rodgers here because I do think there's a way that it actually ties in locally. And I threw this out earlier with Bart. I am blown away by the fact that the Packers have put themselves in this position. And earlier today, Adam Schefter reported that the Packers, at one point here in the offseason, offered him a two-year extension that would have made him the highest paid player in the league again. And it would have, in theory, had him locked up until age 43. Now, we know in the NFL, they mess around with contracts and such. Right? Right. Listen to Schefter as far as why Rodgers is in this position and why he was turning down this extension.
Right now, it's hard for me to imagine that Aaron Rodgers would report to camp with 3 years left on that contract. And we know that this is not about money because the Packers have offered him a lengthy extension. They've offered him a lucrative extension. He has not taken any of that money. I don't believe that that's what he's interested in. He's not looking for added riches. He's looking, I think, to figure out a way out of Green Bay. And the way that these two sides can conduct those talks here over the next week will dictate whether or not Aaron Rodgers would be there on the first day of training camp 1 week from today.
So it sounds as if the only way he's going to be there next week is if the Packers agree to let him walk after this season. He wants the final 3 years of his contract amended and reduced down to 1 year and wants to take one last shot at it, but wants to have his freedom after this year, whether that's his way to get like Tom Brady or whatever. He wants a contract reduction. The Packers have been steadfast that they're not going to trade him. So I ask this question. You've been dumb enough to handle things so poorly for so long to put yourself in this position with your franchise quarterback, with one of the top two quarterbacks in the league, basically. Your team president has put his foot in his mouth every time he speaks about it. The GM is not the world's greatest communicator, clearly. And Rodgers is not happy with the way things are. So he wants to go somewhere else. But he doesn't need to be traded this second. If you're the Packers, what are you doing here? Are you going to ride this out and force the issue and let this hang over Jordan Love throughout training camp and early part of the regular season if Rodgers isn't showing up? Because I got news for you. Rodgers is smarter than Brian Gutekunst, and he is smarter than Mark Murphy. And if he says that he's going to sit out, I believe that Aaron Rodgers is going to sit out. Thoroughly believe that. So, you can try to call his bluff. I don't think that's going to work. So that really leaves you with two options. Do you trade him away and try to get what you can, which will still be an exceptionally attractive package? And right now, you just start building for the future. Or do you make another run at it? Do you believe that you're right there to win a championship? If I'm the Packers, I'm having trouble going after it one more time. I honestly am thinking about trading him and doing that now. And the reason is this. I don't want to let him walk away for nothing. I don't want to see that happen. Now, I understand where I was last year. Okay? I had a chance to go to the Super Bowl. I had a chance to beat Tom Brady. I had a chance to win another title. And it's going to be awfully difficult to not think of it in those terms after you went 13-3 last season and not think, I can be right back there again. We all know how much has to go your way to win. But the Packers are trying to have their cake and eat it too here. They want Rodgers to do an extension so that they can re-sign Devontae Adams, so that they can maneuver some other things and keep some of their guys in place. And they don't want to make him happy given how bad the situation has gotten. I get it. This is somebody that is under contract, and people will look at that and say, well, you should just show up to work. You're under contract. You go to work. That's what you do. Well, doesn't seem like that's happening. I'm more tempted to try to move into the future faster. I'm more tempted to give myself a chance to try to win down the road and start building into that future. And so if I'm going to do that, I can't let Aaron Rodgers walk away for nothing. And that's what I'd be doing. I can't do that. What if I don't win a title this year? I mean, that's the only way that it's actually a good thing. It's the only way that it's even at least somewhat palatable. And even then, you win a title, he walks away, that's going to be awkward. So when you factor all of that stuff in, I really have trouble, if I'm Green Bay, putting all my eggs in one more season's basket, one more run at it. So if I were the Packers, I'd think about trading him now. And I have to tell you, and I know what you're going to say, okay? But if I were the Giants, I'd look at it. Because the Giants might have what it takes to get him. Do the Packers believe in Jordan Love? I don't know. Doesn't feel like there's a strong belief there. I think it's foolhardy to try to evaluate a guy off of a COVID year. No OTAs, no preseason games, not a whole lot of snaps to get better. That to me is very difficult to try to say whether or not you definitively have the guy. But Daniel Jones and two first-round picks next year? Remember, they have a second first-round pick next year for Aaron Rodgers? With everything the Giants have, they are built to win in the relative short term, are they not? They are. So if I were the Giants, and it looks like the Packers decide they're going to change up their minds on this, even though it's in the conference, and I know how unlikely it is, I at least have to make the call, don't I? This is never going to happen. I'm Steve Cohen right now. Let's play GM, right? But wouldn't you do that? Of course you would. Of course you would. As we said, over the next 2 weeks, we're going to preview the AFC East and the NFC East. This week, the AFC East. We begin tonight with the Miami Dolphins camp right around the corner. We head to South Florida. You hear her on the weekends on ESPN Radio. She is Amber Wilson from ESPN Radio down in Miami. Amber, it's Chris. How you doing?
Hey, Chris. I'm good. How are you?
I'm doing outstanding. So, Amber, here's the first question. Can Tua Tagovailoa play quarterback?
That is a good question. And if I had the answer to it, I would be worth a lot of money, I think. Nobody has the answer to that question. That's the reality of it. Anybody that says that they do one way or another, they are lying. I mean, we're talking about a guy who we saw for like half the season. He was coming off of that major hip injury in college. He's sitting on the bench. He's having to watch Ryan Fitzpatrick play football when, by the way, Tua didn't, of course, get training camp. He didn't get the preseason game, the pandemic. Then he finally gets some opportunities there in the second half of the season to start. But he's watching Ryan Fitzpatrick have to come in for him at times as he's getting benched. I really don't know what to make of it. I mean, Tua obviously had some moments. He did some good stuff. He did some not so good stuff. He had 11 touchdowns, 5 interceptions, an 87.1 passer rating. None of that's awful. You know, I don't think you could say that he's a total flop. I just have no idea. I don't know what we have, and I'm not sure that it's really fair to judge him considering all those circumstances that I just mentioned.
Well, Amber, if you were to give the front office and Brian Flores truth serum, do they believe in Tua right now from the perception on the outside, you think?
I would say this. I don't know because they're, of course, going to say that they do and that they have the utmost confidence and yada, yada, blah, blah, blah. I would say that that's questionable because you did see them bench him for Fitzpatrick at times last season when Tua had gotten the start. So there were obviously things Tua did that they were not thrilled with, and Flores wasn't scared to send him a message in those moments. And also, the Dolphins had found themselves in a position where they were trying to clinch a playoff berth. I mean, they were in that position at one point. 10 wins didn't end up being good enough to do it, but they were trying to make the playoffs. So they were trying to actually win games there at the end of the season, and they felt like Ryan Fitzpatrick at times was giving them a better opportunity to do that. I mean, maybe that's not rocket science, right? I mean, Fitzpatrick's obviously been in the league for longer than I've been alive, and he was a rook, and with all those circumstances I just mentioned, it doesn't mean that they were totally out on Tua, but I do think that they couldn't have been as confident in him, at least in those moments, as they pretended like they were. And then, Chris, they did that thing in this draft where they traded back, and I think they traded back to 12, and then they traded back up to 6 in this draft. And when they traded back initially, they picked up another first-rounder in 2023. And my evaluation of that, and then they hung on to that one. They ended up getting another one in 2022. They traded away to trade back up. But they hung on to the multiple first-rounders in 2023. And my personal evaluation, I have no sources on this, I looked at that and I thought, I think that they're doing that. That's their insurance policy if Tua doesn't work out. Because I think they're thinking, okay, we know in a couple of years here what we have with Tua, and then we'll have an insurance policy in 2023 where we can address it at the top of that draft, whether we'll be in a position to pick at the top of the draft a quarterback. Either way, we'll have the firepower to trade up to do it because we've got multiple first rounders. So I'm guessing that's their plan. I'm guessing, to answer your question in a really long way, that the jury's still out for them also. I don't think they know what they have into us.
Amber Wilson of ESPN Radio joins us to preview the Miami Dolphins as we take a look around the division. Well, they've given him playmakers, that's for sure, and they've added to it with, you know, they've with Parker and Fuller, you've already got big-time wide receivers, and then you add Jalen Waddle to the mix, along with Gesicki, who's a pretty good tight end. So there really shouldn't be too many excuses there for him, as we've seen with other teams, like with the Jets, with Sam Darnold over the last couple of years. So do they feel like at this point they've surrounded him with enough to be successful on that offense?
Yeah, in terms of pass catchers, I mean, they also have Preston Williams. Parker and Williams have had some injury concerns, but when they have been fully healthy, they've looked great. You mentioned the other speed weapons that they brought in. So in terms of pass catchers, you're absolutely right. I mean, he has the weapons. He doesn't have an excuse from that perspective. I would say the only area that he might have an excuse is with the O-line, because he had 3 rookies on it last season. They had some moments, Jackson, Robert Hunt, Solomon Kittley, they had some moments. Obviously, they'll be more developed this season, but those dudes are young. Then you bring in Liam Eichenberg, who's a rookie this season. You bring in a new center in Skura out of Baltimore. So, you know, that line, that O-line is very fresh overall and still developing and is still going to need to build more chemistry and gel together more. That would be the only excuse, I would say. I also don't love the backfield. The running back position certainly could use some work. It seems like they brought in Malcolm Brown, but it seems like Miles Gaskin is the guy at that position. But in terms of pass catchers, he absolutely has the weapons. And in terms of Dolphins fans, the biggest complaint last season about Tua was that there was no big play-making ability there that we saw. He wasn't airing it out at all. And when Fitzpatrick was in the game, it was like a completely different offense. So I think that bringing in those speed weapons, a guy like Jalen Waddle, who was the fastest receiver in this draft, I think that brings in, of course, that big playmaking ability, and we've seen Will Fuller already have that ability with the Texans.
All right, defensive side, Amber. how good do the Dolphins expect to be? Because when you look at a lot of these positions, they've spent draft picks and they've brought in some really, really good players. On paper, it looks like they should be a much improved defense.
I mean, I think they already had a much improved defense last season. I mean, I think really the defense is what's responsible for taking them from 5-11 Florida's first year, 10-6 last season. So they already flipped things around really dramatically between year one and year two, and I think that's a credit to the defense. I mean, they had an NFL-leading 29 takeaways last season. Obviously, that defense, the best player on that defense is Xavien Howard. He leads that defense. He had 10 interceptions last season. He was in the conversation for NFL player, defensive player of the year. I don't know what's happening there with that contract situation. That situation has gotten a little complicated. But, of course, you have Byron Jones on the other side of him. And you have a bunch of weapons on that defense. Jones, Baker, the linebacker position, even Andrew Van Ginkle has come along. I think that Dolphins defense is going to continue to impress. And that's not surprising because, of course, you're talking about, you know, a former D coordinator in Brian Flores, and you would expect that to really be his bread and butter. And that is certainly proved to be the case so far.
Where is Brian Flores? Where is the essence of him in this team? We know he's a defensive guy, but I guess in the mentality of Brian Flores, is it more of a Belichick type situation, or, you know, do we see somebody who's a little bit more, I don't know, someone with a personality?
I think it's somewhere in between. He's certainly known as stiff and rigid as Belichick. I mean, he does have his Belichick kind of moments with some of the pressers, where you just don't, you're not going to get much from Flores, but he's also not a jerk about it. You know,
yeah.
Where obviously we get that impression from Bill.
He's respectful in not answering questions.
Right, exactly. He's still not giving you anything. At the end of the day, it's still the same result, but the delivery is slightly different, slightly kinder. But Flores is definitely a Bill Belichick disciple. I mean, I do wonder, like, with the Xavien Howard contract situation, X is holding out. He's trying to renegotiate a year into a five-year extension where they had just given him an extension, and he's doing that because, hey, that other quarterback on the team is getting paid even more than me, and I'm the best player, I think X could argue, on the entire Miami Dolphins team. So that's the situation that Flores is dealing with right now in Chris Greer. And I have thought, you know, how is that for a Bill Belichick kind of guy? Because I can't see Belichick wanting to hand anybody a new contract a year after handing them a new extension, you know? So I don't know how that's going to work out there. But overall, Flores is, you know, not so far removed from Belichick coaching tree, but far enough where he is very well-respected. People are really, really high on him. Dolphins fans love him down here. And that's without the Super Bowls yet. I mean, he's just a very likable head football coach.
Amber Wilson of ESPN Radio. She's down in Miami and knows the Dolphins inside and out. She's joining us to help us preview the Dolphins as we go around the AFC East this week. Okay, Amber, what is the realistic expectation of the Dolphin fan for this season coming off of 10-6? Or have they not settled on one simply because of Tua?
Well, Dolphins fans are all over the map with Tua. I mean, I am, I think, a bit reasoned here when I tell you the jury's still out. It's a big question mark. There are Dolphins fans that are devout who will tell you he's the next coming. He's amazing. I don't know what they're watching that I'm not seeing. But then there's, of course, people on the flip side that are already way past. He's terrible. He's awful. Look at him compared to Justin Herbert and Joe Burrow. And he, you know, he's a total mess and that kind of thing. So there are the extremes with the Dolphins fans. I think overall, though, you're talking about a team that hasn't had a playoff win in 20 years. So I think getting one of those would be a really good place to start. 10 wins last season, Chris, obviously, was a surprise. I mean, I think that was they were working ahead of schedule, getting just 10 wins last season, because, like I mentioned earlier, they went from 5-11 to 10-6. That's a pretty remarkable turnaround. Building on that, I mean, first they need to make the playoffs, right? And then I think getting a playoff win, I mean, I think that would really elate Dolphins fans down here if you could get a playoff win, and then we'll move on from there. But I would say that that's probably the ceiling of the expectation this season.
Yeah, and I mean, normally my final question on this would be, the Dolphins will contend for the division if, and look for the final part of that sentence, but it sounds like we all know what that if is, and it's simply the most important position on the field.
Yeah, I mean, that if is Tua, right? Because I think it's fair to say that if Tua had a season like Justin Herbert had last season, we'd be talking about this Dolphins team like a potential Super Bowl contender. I mean, that defense is that good. So if they had the quarterback to do it with the weapons that they brought in at receiver, you'd feel a lot more confident that this team is really a contending kind of team. And with Tua, you just have no idea. So everything really rides on his development, and that's going to be the thing that everyone's going to be tuned in to see this season.
Is Herbert the guy that's, I mean, you look at the draft and how it went, is he the guy that's going to be held over Tua's head, basically?
I mean, just forever. Unfortunately, right?
Yeah.
I mean, that's how we do things. They don't have anything to do with each other. They're not mutually exclusive. Just because Justin Herbert's great doesn't mean Tua can't also be great. I mean, they could both be Hall of Famers. They're not the same person. They're not even the same type of quarterback. But that is going to happen. That comparison's always going to happen because the Dolphins had an opportunity to draft him. Maybe it's going to compare him. Joe Burrow can go on to be the best quarterback in history. And that's not going to be part of the conversation because the Dolphins weren't there at number one to take him. But Herbert goes at sixth. They draft Tua at fifth. They had that opportunity to draft Justin Herbert. And that can be a franchise-changing type of opportunity that can ruin a franchise for decades, making that mistake. But like I said, at least they do have those multiple first-rounders in 2023 to try to correct the situation if they did make that kind of mistake.
Amber, great stuff. Appreciate it. We'll talk soon.
Thanks, Chris.
Amber Wilson of ESPN Radio. You hear her on the weekends here on 98.7. She will be on this weekend as well. So make sure you check her out. She will be on, I believe, on Saturday and Sunday this week. But the one thing I'd point out about the Dolphins is they are a team that they frankly scare me, right? I don't expect the Jets to win the division this year. Of course not. I expect not even baby steps, good size steps. If Tua's the guy, the Dolphins are really set up pretty nicely for a few years. I mean, look at what they've added with Fuller. Look at what they've added with Jalen Waddle on the offensive side. Their line should be better. They're really well coached, and their defense is excellent. If they get the Xavien Howard situation straightened out, the Dolphins and the Bills are right there to take control of this division for a long time. And that's why I think, well, the Jets are very much headed in the right direction. This division is going to be a dogfight year in and year out for the next 5-6 years. I truly believe that. I mean, we already know what the Bills are. And if Tua is the answer, look out, Jack. This is not going to be easy.
You're listening to Chris Carlin on 98.7 ESPN.